Look at the screen.
William Blake's The Great Red Dragon and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
I know that I'm not smarter than you.
Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
Do you see?
You're so sly. So am I.
Do you see?
You're supposed to be his friend, Jack. Why didn't you leave him alone?
Do you see? Mrs. Leeds, do you see?
Yes.
You want the scent?
Smell yourself.
Do you see?
Just you and me now, sport.
Do you see?
You've seen these films, haven't you, my man?
You owe me all.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Mindhunter. This is a podcast examining Michael Mann's 1986 adaptation of Thomas Harris's amazing pulp novel, Red Dragon, Manhunter. The show is Mindhunter. It could have been Man with two N's. Thank you, Manola Dargis, for reminding me. Every time I do this introduction now, I have to credit Manola for saying it could have been Manhunter, Blake. And you know what? She's actually right. But, you know, in our brand of One Heat Minute Productions, it had to be Mindhunter. So here we are. We are at the 20th scene, not the number of episodes because you guys would have listened to more, but 20th scene in the film, well and truly ramping up toward the climax. And the run of guests, the hits keep on coming. Today, I've got a friend who reached out to me maybe 7 or 8 years ago when One Heat Minute had started. We had some conversations there that immediately made us fast friends. The last time I saw this person was in person, which, as I've done this series, so many folks who came to see Katie Walsh and I on stage at the Egyptian LA at the American Cinematheque for the Miami Vice screening with a secret special guest, one Michael Mann. We saw each other there. He's such a talent. I love his long-form pieces for Bright Wall Dark Room. I love his stuff way back when it was on the Metaplex, like his first stuff. There, he's a primo film mind. He says things that make sense all the time, and then sometimes people go absolutely berserk at him on social media for the most reasonably well-thought-out takes. And I have no understanding of how he conjures this this dark magic, but I respect the living daylights out of this guy. He's a dear friend. He's a staff writer at Next Best Picture, but you've seen his work across a bunch of places. I've already mentioned perhaps Bright Wall Dark Room, where he's done a couple of amazing pieces on Chris Nolan films, but particularly also at RogerEbert.com. He's a friend and family and forever lifetime Hall of Fame crew member on One Heat Minute Productions. It's Brendan Hodges. Brendan, hello, my friend.
I could not be happier to be here, with the one exception that I hate that there's now this barrier between us. Because, listeners, when I saw Blake in LA, when I flew out really just to see him, there were many hugs. We could not
stop. Oh, my God. We couldn't stop touching each other.
We were just so happy. One of the happiest kind of runs of days of my entire year. And it's just, I'm so happy to be here.
It was amazing. We spent a number of days and nights together. It was so great. And yeah, the symptom of having forged so many strong friendships online is that when you're together, like, I literally had to give people disclaimers. I'm sorry. I'm going to grab you. I'm going to hold your shoulder while you're next to me talking, because I can't do that. Like, I have to know that this isn't real. I have to know that it's not just some like strange dream that I've been, that is so vivid, you know, Inception style, of like me having this really full lived experience and then not knowing that you're real. But yeah, it's sad, but it's also brilliant to see you again here. This year is that moment in this year has been like like someone with tachycardia in my life. You know, there's ups and downs, but the spikes are scarily high on that list. And that weekend was just ongoing cardiac arrest. But somehow I pulled through and survived. So here we are. And we're here to talk about another Man film.
Yeah, we're here to talk about Manhunter, which it's a movie that I've honestly struggled with the most out of Mann's main line of films. And I've thought so much about why that is, and we'll get into it. But part of it is I've discovered and realized it's the least like most of his other movies.
Yes.
Part of that is probably that it's an adaptation of not just a novel, but a very specifically written novel in tone and style.
Yes.
That I don't think he returns to again, but by that same token, there's all of these beautiful mannisms throughout. It somehow is like a perfectly of a piece with his other movies, but it also stands apart. And part of that for me is that it is such like a dreamy, surreal, at times nightmarish film that like disobeys conventional narrative forms all the time. It almost has this dream logic to it, whereas his other films, I associate them like having that like effervescent quality where they feel almost like metaphysical. They transcend life, but they're also so physical and tactile. And there's moments like that here, but the whole film just has this like twinkling surrealism through the whole thing that as I've rewatched it, as I've aged, has only gotten like deeper and deeper inside me.
Yeah.
And much like Will Graham. And yeah, I'm excited to dive into it more. I think it's just a really singular film in his filmography.
Yeah, I think you and I have this affinity with filmmakers that we love is you love sometimes the outliers, or what you at least preliminarily feel like are the outliers in someone's filmography. They grate at you because you kind of your expectations or your inner reading of how that filmmaker's work plays out for you as an audience member is challenged by something. And so sometimes when you watch it, it grates at you, but that has this effect where it's like, you know, it's like a scratch on your hand, or it's like that niggling thing. It's like, what is it about that thing? And for me, I was much the same. I watched this and it flew by early. It wasn't one that I immediately revisited after seeing it. It was kind of always on the peripheral until really, you know, the kind of the genesis of like the One Heat Minute projects when I was really revisiting a lot of Michael Mann stuff around that time. And I was like, I just couldn't believe how good it was because it had these haunting images that just stayed with me in my subconscious for long periods of time. And if I was sort of musing or not consciously thinking about something, images from Manhunter would be in my head. And that's just how affecting and how kind of like this tattooing effect that Michael Mann's great images have, which is like you just have these things in your subconscious. They just sit there because he's orchestrated them in such a way. And so, yeah, I totally agree. It's definitely got that about it. And as you said, it comes with a whole other series of pop cultural baggage because everyone talks about Thomas Harris and everyone talks about Silence of the Lambs as a masterpiece and a genre, you know, buster itself. Like it just broke the genre at the time. And then there were so many different kinds of serial killer fiction and imitators that came after it. There's the great TV show Hannibal, which I love and adore, and Mads Mikkelsen, maybe my favorite working actor. I looked at like my, you know how you do like your Letterboxd top 10 of whatever years. It was like successive years where I went back and I was like 2 years in a row, Mads Mikkelsen was like my top actor was the lead actor of both of those films. And I was just like, man alive, he is good. And so, yeah, you get these times where it's like, it's in the conversation always. And for me also, the challenge is Manhunter always became some kind of lesser curio in that.
No, yeah, 100%.
And the more that I watched it, I kept thinking to myself, firstly, as a Thomas Harris adaptation, I was like, you're all wrong. Like the arguments that this is not as good as Red Dragon, Brett Ratner's film, is patently ridiculous. The arguments that it's like not as equally as interesting an adaptation or as in the league of Silence of the Lambs, was also crazy to me. So yeah, it's, they were just different, completely different, tonally different. And I think also the, I love Michael Mann, Jonathan Demme, Ridley Scott running into each other, adapting the same thing, applying their style to something. It becomes this great, beautiful, incongruous directorial triumvirate where these three guys do their thing. A very keenly sort of observed thing with these three different texts, and they're very fascinating to me. So I'm very glad that you're here, because I'm excited to talk to you about this scene. This is a great scene. It has, it's an hour, 25 minutes, 45 seconds in the theatrical cut to about 1 hour, 29 minutes and 29 seconds ish, around those moments. I'm excited with Brendan to unpick it because he's written for Roger Ebert. So Roger Ebert's Cinema Interruptus inspired the particular adjustment to our format for this series. So I'm so excited to get into it with him. So Brendan, we're gonna hit play and we can interrupt this bad boy as many ways as we like. So we've just seen Francis, Dolehide and Reba kissing beautifully at sunrise on a dock. And we're now back with Will Graham poring over case files in drab hotel rooms. And we're going to see if he can start figuring Francis out. And this scene really almost teaches us the perspective of Francis Dolehide. So it's going to be super fun to go into his mind and into his lens and see what Will Graham learns here. So let's get to it.
You got the message Lecter called?
Yeah, I arranged for him to have a phone. I got to call him in a few minutes.
Good, listen. We identified the tire tracks left when Lounge was delivered back to the Tatler. G7816 Goodyear truck tires. Looks like our boy drives a van. I'm setting up our base in Chicago. When are you coming back?
When I'm done, Jack.
I got to pause this because there's this establishing shot of this scene. I just took it back a couple of seconds for Brendan and I. It's so great. It's like case files poured over the bed, a coat, his bag unpacked, not unpacked rather, his little sort of notes, a soft packet of cigarettes, his dictaphone. I love that he's just in bare feet and he's still in his suit. He's just like there. The room, getting himself set up in the room is not the objective of this space. It's this great overhead shot, almost like surveillance POV in this it's a ghastly pink. It's like very, very 80s pink. And we see that old school television, but it's just this great shot of like, this guy is just like, he comes into a space, he just drops all his shit and the focus is not about making himself comfortable. It's about doing his job.
Yeah. And just to say really quick, the pink here, as you say, is so 80s and Manhunter itself is so 80s.
It is.
On so many different levels, the soundtrack, the attire, the vibes, the production design. And this is not one type of pink. We have a whole spectrum of ugly pinks here. There's like a fuchsia. There's like a really off salmon pink here. And what I think is actually
spectrum
super important about this
spectrum of pinks,
is how beautifully it cuts to the medium shots and close-ups that the rest of the scene, for the most part, takes place in. Where the camera's positioned on like a level medium shot with Will Graham against the backdrop of his window with like a classic man, almost like one of those like geometric architecture Antonioni-esque shots.
Yes.
And that would not have the impact it does visually if we didn't start in this room at this wide shot with all these pinks.
Yes.
So there's like a really smart and thoughtful visual design, not just within individual shots, but how the edits will have these moments go off one another.
Yeah, you're so right. The spectrum of pink is the perfect contrast because it's like the movie makes that pattern of Will Graham being ridiculously uncomfortable in almost every space that he's in. And this one is no exception. In fact, it's kind of the most aggressively different from the blues and the whites of his rooms. It's like this is kind of an aggressive color palette for him. And so as he's about to pivot, it's so great. So let's just quickly, I'm just going to let this play out as he finishes talking to Jack. Dolehide drives a van. They're discovering more things from the tire tracks and he leans back.
I'm done, Jack.
And there's this gorgeous, it's just Will against the darkness. It's so fantastic.
There it is.
There it is. 1 hour, 26 minutes, 18 seconds. It's this. He's in this chair, which is now kind of drowned out by the white. These dark exterior balconies. We've got these like sheer on the left-hand side, sort of very angular building that's next to the hotel that he's in. And then in the background, there is some kind of office building that's got this sort of haloed top. So you can just sort of see the sketch of the outline at the back there. And it's just a shot as he's leaning back into his chair. And it's all darkness. All darkness is tiny bit of white. His brown skin. It's just really fantastic. It's a money shot.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those shots that when there's like the four picture grids on Twitter yes. where people share like screenshots of Manhunter, it's usually like this shot is always almost like one of those.
Yeah.
It has become one of the defining images of the movie. And I think, as I say, like you have so many visual signifiers of kind of his psychology and where he's at. He's sort of being torn apart at this part of the film, at this moment. And even the building to screen left is off axis
yes.
from the balcony that we're looking out of. It's not perpendicular. It's not in parallel. It's this like awkward, like 25 degree angle off, yes. which just creates all of this like visual pressure.
It's pointing. It's like the pressure is pointing to him because the framing of the balcony is like making it like an arrow, where it's like the whole building is trying to squeeze itself towards Will.
Yeah, exactly. And to me, Mann's best shots, or a lot of them at least, are the ones where you have like a solitary character in the frame. They're kind of isolated and yet overwhelmed by all of these geometric forces around them, and we can kind of see how the space of the where the character is in becomes a visual metaphor for where the character's headspace is at that moment. Like we all know, if we know Mann, we all know the exact shots that I'm talking about. Macaulay in front of the ocean would be one, but this to me is like one of the shots of the whole film, and as we'll see, it counterpoints so perfectly the conversation he's about to have.
Yeah, I buried the lead a little. We have a great chat. He's revisiting some time with a dear friend, a friend who's curious about his dreams, one Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, this is Will Graham of the FBI. Dr. Chilton arranged for me to talk to Dr. Lecter. Hello?
Congratulate you for the job you did on Mr. Lambs. I admired it enormously. Oh, what a cunning boy you are, Will.
The next cut is Brian Cox. This is why Brian Cox's Hannibal Lecter is so delectable for me, is that this cut, an hour 26, 44 seconds, he's lounging. He's got these double socks because it's probably cold in his cell. He's lounging. His feet are completely up, and he's just so he's holding the phone to his ear with like this weird pillow maneuver so that it's still comfortable for him to like be lounging about. He's so happy and comfortable here, Brandon. It's just a brilliant, I mean, the conversation is going to occupy a lot of our conversation, but just the visual of Will kind of sort of relaxed and sort of feels comfortable. His shirt's open, he's comfortable. And Lecter, who's been, you know, starts this conversation lounging with him previously and then gets up into his much more sort of intimidating, animalistic, predatory gaze mode where he's like staring from, you know, his chin's low and his eyes are up like a prize fighter. But now he's just like, he's talking to his girlfriend, you know, he's talking to his partner lounging about the, you know, wherever he is. And it just happens to be in a cell in a psychiatric hospital in Baltimore.
I forget now whose review it was, but I read a Letterboxd review on Manhunter that said, this is a weird thing to say, but in fact, I do remember it's Darren Mooney, the Irish critic. And he said, this is a weird thing to say, but it's weird how normal the serial killers are in this movie. Yeah. Like just how human they are. And I think this scene, this shot in particular, exemplifies what Darren had meant, where we see them kind of using the familiar positions and behaviors of our own lives. They're not often corners, scheming, being evil, sitting in the shadows. They're not, you know, sitting there going, who can I kill next? No, their evil plans are waged from positions of relaxation and comfort. Like, this is a conversation, the way that he's laying here, that might be me sprawled on my couch, Blake, yeah, like breaking down the new Ferrari trailer last year with my friends. What did you think about the color palette? What do you think it's going to be as good or worse as Black Cat, right? Like, we could have a relaxing conversation, but here he is, Hannibal Lecter, in that similar position of comfort.
This is plunging into the
depths of Will's mind.
This is you and I when Chris Nolan's new film is announced. You know, you'll just be sitting lounging in your beautiful Chicago home, looking out to like harsh landscapes, and I'll be lying down at whatever weird, strange time in Australia, talking on an old phone. Oh yeah, it's got Tom Holland, Matt Damon, Zendaya, Anne Hathaway. Wow, this is gonna be great. You know, when they finally announce what the hell that thing is, so great. Yeah. You look at the Ferrari trailer. What is? I just want to dub your friend's conversation over this. What do you think of the colors? You know, you like it? New meme incoming.
I'm sick of you crazy sons of bitches, Lecter. You got something to say, say it.
I want to help you. You'd be more comfortable if you relaxed with yourself. We don't invent our natures. They're issued to us along with our lungs and pancreas and everything else. Why fight it?
So I want to pause right here.
Yes.
That quote I wrote down in prep for this, which is, we don't invent our natures. They're issued to us along with our lungs and pancreas and everything else. Why fight it? So at the beginning of this conversation, I mentioned how at odds or kind of an outlier it is from Mann's other films. And yet, as I've aged and seen the film more and more times, as I've become more and more familiar with Mann's work, because when I first saw this, exactly like you said, it was like this curio. It was like, oh, here's Hannibal Lecter before they figured it out.
Yes.
I saw it more as a Hannibal Lecter film than a Michael Mann film. Like, I loved Heat and The Insider and Collateral, but I had not become the complete like Mann lunatic that I am now. But now seeing it through the lens of a Mann film rather than strictly a Hannibal Lecter film, this is one of Mann's core themes repeated as a major motif across his whole filmography, this idea of kind of the animal nature inside us. There's that, you know, amazing monologue in Heat where, you know, there's the signs of passing and the description of Hannah as this almost nocturnal predator on the hunt for criminals. And we have these through lines of his films where it's people placed under duress where they reckon with who they are. And so much of who they are things they did not seem to choose, whether it's their background, whether it's their personality, whether it's what turns them on. It's, you know, whether they want to escape. They have these hopes and dreams and nightmares, and they have wonderful strengths and weaknesses. And these are things that, for the most part, they have a feeling is outside of their control. No theme more so than time in Mann's films, this idea of running out of time and how that pressurized existence of life kind of makes those latent behaviors become more explicit. And I think this one sentence by Lecter, I haven't read Red Dragon. I have no idea if this is a direct quote from the book, but to me, this is so much of Mann's pet ideas made very, very clear and explicit.
Yeah, and it's also, I think that's the great thing about this film in Mann's filmography is that Mann, no matter what, and it comes to Collateral, you know, as well, which is a Stuart Beattie script, but there's just so much in how Mann interprets and adds colors, adds shades between the text that make it so about him. So that emphasizing the line from Peterson here about, like, essentially he's saying, and I don't need the verbatim, essentially saying, don't waste my time. You're wasting my time. I'm running out of time. Don't waste my time. And Lecter's trying to play this game with him. And so you at least see with Will's posture that he's like, don't waste my time, but he's relaxed. He's not up. He's not charged.
They're getting a little too close.
Yes.
As well. The barriers between Will, the detective, and Will person who makes all these like psychological sketches, the barrier between him, the professional, and the sort of radical empathy that he has to practice, where he projects into the minds of serial killers, those barriers and protections are going away. So there's this really clever thing happening where we start with Will looking completely out of place in this room of those like ugly pinks, and he looks very, very uncomfortable. And now he's relaxing. How is he relaxing more when he's on the phone with a serial killer? Not only a serial killer, but one who's basically trying to mind fuck him.
And also his shirt is open in the scene. And we know that Lecter has tried to gut him. And so now he's like, his arms are closed and his open shirt in his relaxation mode is now closed over as well. It's like, how could you possibly feel comfortable ever talking to Hannibal Lecter? At least the distance is, I'm states away from this guy. I'm literally hundreds or maybe thousands of miles away. And that's a good thing.
Ensuring your baby gets the nutrients they need to support their growth and development is a top priority for every parent. That's why millions around the globe have turned to A2 Platinum as the formula they trust. A2 Platinum Premium Infant Formula is nutritionally complete with whole milk as the first ingredient. Their A2 whole milk comes from specifically selected cows that naturally produce milk containing only the A2 protein and no A1. With 30-plus select nutrients, A2 Platinum is specifically designed with tiny tummies in mind and without worry of harmful chemicals. Quality and safety are the number one priority for A2 Platinum. Plus, they are clean label Project Purity Award certified. Join millions of parents and choose A2 Platinum for your little one. Right now, for a limited time only, A2 is offering podcast listeners 25% off their first purchase when you use promo code podcast25 at checkout on Amazon or at a2platinum.com. Again, for 25% off your first order, go to Amazon or a2platinum.com and use the promo code podcast25.
But let's keep unlocking this great chat that they have together.
Wait, what?
Did you really feel so depressed after you shot Mr. Garrett and Jacob Hobbs to death? I didn't know you then, but I think you probably did.
But it wasn't the act that got you down, was it? Didn't you really feel so bad because killing him felt so good, and why shouldn't it feel good?
It must feel good to God. He does it all the time.
Garrett Jacob Hobbs, let's pause it there. Famous, if you've seen the Hannibal series, the whole basically first season's all about this guy, Garrett Jacob Hobbs. And it's the case that brought Lecter to Will's attention. And he's then riffing back on this theme of like, you had to kill him, but it felt good. And he's like, it must feel good. You know, if one does what God does as much as God does, then one becomes what God is, or something like that. I think I got that pretty right. And so we're about to hear that phrase, and it's him just like, it must have felt good, you know? It felt so good. And Will's sort of smiling because maybe the cognitive distance of he's not in the same space as me, he's like really seeing the trick. So right now, as we've paused it on like 1 hour, 27 minutes, 24 seconds, he's just sort of smiling at like, I can see through this guy's game a little bit better and a little bit more objectively than I could when I was in front of him. So it's just this fun, he's just so playful. Oh, why wouldn't it feel good? Brian Cox in that moment, Brendan, I don't know if you caught it. I certainly did because I've maybe watched this movie and this scene too many times. I'm going to play it for us. He's just wiggling his toes.
Didn't you really feel so bad?
He's just, he's moving. So good, and why shouldn't it feel good? He wiggles his toes. He's so great. Oh my gosh. Fantastic.
Yeah. And his relaxation now has become the posture of power.
Yes.
And again, like the scene, this is why I love that you did this the podcast series that you've done, especially on Heat, but all of them, because very few filmmakers, you can find like a richness just on a second to second, shot to shot level.
Yes.
We're already in this particular scene over, you know, not even a few minutes here. we're seeing visual ideas established, subverted, changed, reinforced, moved around, all by the context of what is the subject matter. And all of these ideas are kind of working together. And again, that idea of God and nature and bringing us closer to God, it reminds me so much of what we're talking about with the nature inside us. And, you know, I don't know how to do anything else. You know, do you know, like neither do I, all that stuff. We are who we are. And what makes Will a unique Michael Mann protagonist is that he's almost a character you would expect to see in a late period Michael Mann film, reflecting on these themes in retrospect, because he's a character whose nature by definition has to be plastic. Yes. Because he's projecting all these other selves inside of him to solve all these crimes. And that sort of interrogates these core Michael Mann themes. And usually a filmmaker using those types of characters and that those types of narrative tricks, they're doing that with a movie like The Irishman, or they're doing that with a movie like The Wind Rises or The Boy and the Heron, or like those late career films that look back in retrospect. But this is like one of Mann's first films and an adaptation. So it's just so fascinating to me now as a character, he is sort of prophesizing so much of how Mann's characters come to see themselves and kind of fight their nature and deal with those themes head on.
Yeah, there was a great conversation I had with Megan Abbott in this series. And one thing that Megan stuck with me, and I'm going to join the dots for you, is she said, it's almost like man is simultaneously creating the myth and then exploding the myth. And I just love that turn of phrase, because it is truly, it's like, it's the myth making of the serial killer genre, but at the same time, it's interrogating it and not doing that sort of almost like irresponsibly quaint, like, oh, here's this attractive serial killer. It's like it understands the attractions, but it gets to the deep, dark recesses of the human experience that great serial killer fiction does without going into kind of monster movie territory. And so you're so right here. He's sort of self-mythologizing about his protagonists. They do things that are self-destructive, and they can't help it, but their purpose feels really strong and true, and their purpose overrides, like, it overrides kind of like self-preservation. And it's a brilliant touch that he could be so incisive and almost like, you know, you're a huge Minority Report fan, as am I, like precognition of what was to come in an entire genre and his entire career of protagonists. It's pretty incredible. Let's hit play, see what Will's reaction is to Lecter's spouting about God and nature and the nature of us.
God's terrific. He dropped a church roof on 34 of his worshippers last Wednesday night in Texas as they were groveling through a hymn to His Majesty.
Don't you think that felt good?
Why does it feel good, Dr. Lecter?
It feels good, Will, because God has power. And if one does what God does enough times,
one will become as God is.
Firstly, two things. The brilliance of a line, and now a fun digression of a story before we go back to Brendan. What we're watching right now is literally the seconds around 1 hour, 27 minutes, 57 seconds, theatrical cut of Manhunter. William Peterson as Will Graham is sitting in this chair. He hasn't moved. The setup hasn't changed. There's a couple of quick setups, but all the setups between them in this conversation has been back and forth and back and forth. Same two-shot, sort of two-shot in two different locations. Same setups. William Peterson, on a great DVD release of Manhunter, or Blu-ray and DVD release of Manhunter, theatrical and the director's cut, is interviewed retrospectively from being in this movie and talked about working with Michael Mann in Chicago and starting out there. And he's sort of looking back on this film, and he gives a particular bit of color in one of his stories about this scene where he says, we're in this hotel room, and Michael sees these light up lifts in the background. And in the middle of the scene, there's like someone standing in this room where he is off camera with a walkie-talkie waiting to queue up the guys behind them, because Michael Mann had like smuggled people into the building behind him so that at this perfect moment in the scene when he literally has a light bulb go off and unlock a way that he can see Francis Dolarhyde. I'm just going to let it play out while we're talking. A white light lift goes to the top of this building.
He always stays ahead. He got 140 Filipinos in one plane crash last month. Remember that earthquake?
He's even stopped listening to Lecter's sermon about power and God, and this light bulb has literally gone off in his head. It's so, and we're now at like 28 minutes, 1 hour, 28 minutes, 10 seconds. It is just the most magnificent little orchestration. So obvious, like almost like a Warner Brothers cartoon from Tex Avery levels of obvious, but it is so brilliantly orchestrated. And what's happening in the forum background, I think for a moment you don't even remember that Will's there. You can sort of get his reflection cast as he's kind of letting Lecter go on and on. But man alive, when I heard that story and I heard, you know, this little diminutive Chicago-born director has such power and such foresight to like do this little moment and to have this little thing and to orchestrate the logistics of it. This is why I say he's in 86 is absolutely in God mode already. Like, is it any wonder that he then went on to make that run of, you know, Mohicans and Heat and The Insider and Ali and Collateral? Like, I mean, it's brilliant, brilliant storytelling visually.
I never heard that story, but I'm delighted by it, but I'm also not surprised, to be honest. I mean, Mann is one of the foremost directors of knowing the expressive power of far off distant light, yes, in his frames. We talk a lot about how, you know, directors might paint with light, and you know, that's kind of an overused cliche. But Mann, I think, justifies that same idea, where so many of his best shots in his films, whether it's Thief, Heat, Collateral, The Insider, they're full of these moments where the expressive power of artificial light, city light, like man-made like fixtures of light, these things become metaphors for his characters. And the best moments of these in Mann's films, you, at least I don't, intellectually start picking apart the logistics of how he pulled all these, yes, things off. Like the creme de la creme of Mann doing this, of course, is choreographing the planes taking off,
yes,
and landing at the end of Heat, which is unbelievable. Like, all of that stuff is like shadow play, and very rigorously planning when the lights will shine, when they'll turn off. This is a moment that, you're so right, like, you might not even identify what's happening intellectually, but you feel it. It really, yes, nails the expressive visual power of Mann's filmmaking. And he's not scared, I think, to be very direct and very blunt in what he's trying to achieve.
Yeah,
but he still pulls it off, I think, with so much visual lyricism that it doesn't feel crude the way it could if another filmmaker tried something similar.
Yeah, he's everything that has led up to it has earned it in a strange way. You know, it's like you're focused so much on the Lecter Will conversation that this thing that's happening in the background, it feels like ephemera. He's like, no, it just adds to a feeling. It's an unquantifiable element of the scene that if you don't even notice it, you won't. But if you're really clocked in, if you're in this obsessive hyper-focus mode and you want to find Francis too, and maybe it's the first time you watch it and maybe this movie just sang to your inner core that first time and that light moves up and you're just like, bing. It's like literally an idea. It's the sound that an elevator makes when its doors open in most hotels. Bing. It's like, it's,
yeah, but even if you don't intellectually identify it, I totally think that you feel it.
No, that's exactly right. The feeling of bing, like, it doesn't, it's that primal. It's that sort of, yeah, like pre-language. Bing, like that sound, and you that wouldn't, triggers it off.
And you wouldn't experience that, like ping, like that feeling of kind of catharsis that Will is experiencing here if the shot wasn't going, like returning to the same camera position. The stillness of this, which it initially seemed like, okay, the first thing it seems to be doing is creating all this visual pressure on Will. And then he gets more comfortable. And now we're seeing how the visual pressure is sort of transferring to him, getting a little bit too comfortable and familiar with Hannibal Lecter. And now it's become this third thing over the course of just several shots. And we haven't talked about Dante Spinotti specifically by this point, but just Jesus Christ. I mean, so many of the images in the film are, I think, really thrive off like Dante Spinotti's work. And like this series of shots from the same camera position, I think show his genius and microcosm in a really compelling way.
Yeah.
Because there's so much thought into how the camera is placed, how things can change and move that then guide what we're feeling. It also goes back to what we talked about earlier about how there's this dream logic to Manhunter. The big cathartic moment Will is having here didn't come from him poring over case files. It didn't come from him, you know, talking to witnesses. It didn't come from the usual channels of investigative analysis. It came from this sort of free associative kind of thinking where Hannibal Lecter says one thing and Will arrives with something else. And I think that's just sort of a piece with what the whole film is doing.
Oh, absolutely. And I just, Dante's so gracious in the couple of times that we've spoken to him across the years. He's like, Blake, I light the scenes. He goes, Michael composes the frames. I just light the scenes. And I feel like saying like Dante, that's, you know, that's like saying like adding color to a painting after you've done the outline is not an important element of that. And I think it's just the control of holding focus, but having these exterior lighting things be as amorphous and sort of crisp when they need to be. It's just like this collision of ideas. Yeah, he's pretty magnificent. And again, I love there's kind of like a boldness to, there's a boldness to having the bravery to like, after such a dynamic film with so many like different inorganic uses of light, to have this sort of parrying back, this volleying between these two scenes where you're so anchored to a setting of light. Like it's like, we're not augmenting the light. We're not changing the angle. We're not doing, it's just flat. So it has to be really rich and has these right pools of light so that you can catch things like right here where we've paused Will's reflection when he looks over this way, and the sort of taking the shape of the windows with the curtains, and the lower the curtain comes, the brighter the light, and it sets it up that it's kind of like a lamp on him, but it's obviously then augmented. Yeah, it's really brilliant. Let's see if his idea plays out for him here.
I enter.
Let's quickly play that back because I want to hear uninterrupted Lecter talking through that quick moment and Will's thing, just so we can see what drives him into this next scene.
God's so the
light goes up.
He always stays ahead. He got 140 Filipinos in one plane crash last month. Remember that earthquake in Italy last spring?
I enter.
Now we go back to the Leeds home. It's raining out. Another stunning establishing shot here. It's 1 hour, 28 minutes, 16 seconds. And Will is going to narrate. Essentially, he's going to mimic his impression, his empathetic sort of impression of Dolaheyde's process. He's done a lot of observing, but now he's going to try and adopt what he's learned so far. I love the rain on the outside, the leaves running down these like decorative lines out the back of his house. He's opening up, his hair's sodden with water, and he's going into this house.
Yeah, and just to say really quick about this too, this starts a series of lines where he starts speaking in the first person.
Yes.
There's a line coming up where he says, "The house is mine." And, you know, we start here with, you know, with him using that first person subjectivity. And that is a shock and a shift from the way he had been conceptualizing things before. And again, that idea of radical empathy, or yes, the idea of like the terror of pure empathy that Lecter has now bestowed upon him, where he's now seeing this not only through the eyes of Francis, but he's imagining Francis, imagining himself as a God figure.
Yes.
So one thing has perfectly led to the next.
Here we go.
The glass cutter. The piece of glass I take out is mine. The house is mine.
It's also because we've seen him do this walkthrough so many, like, now hours in episodes ago. It was about 8 minutes into the movie where he does this very careful walkthrough of the entire house. It's the house still had furniture because it was still waiting for police review and things like that. It's since sort of had a bit of a clean. But now when he's walking through, it's a completely different perspective that we're seeing him do this. Like, before it was like low angles and his body and gleaning things, but it's just kind of showing it in a very flat way as it is.
Yeah, and the negative space is then filled by his presence.
Yes.
In a way that feels extremely foreboding, which is an interesting kind of contrast, because we should, in theory, we're watching our main character solve a crime, but all of this feels kind of sick. It feels kind of malignant or malevolent. It feels evil. It feels wrong. He's getting too close. And as our proxy, we, the audience, are getting too close.
I walk up these stairs. I pass the children's toys. Children mean nothing to me.
Gosh, what an awful, awful line. And the camera is literally moving sort of perpendicular to him, and it's being swallowed by darkness.
They were put here to help me. I moved to the door. I step into the room.
He just doesn't feel like his same human self as we're here 1 hour, 29 minutes and 1 second. His eyes have got a different glaze about them.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about this central performance is that there are moments where it feels on the surface maybe a bit like overripe. He's definitely playing it very, very big for most of the film. There's all loud choices. And I've come to really love his performance because within that loudness, there's all of these moments of nuance and color. And I think now this scene, when you see that transformation where he has this like somnolent trance-like quality to him, that eeriness would not feel the same if he didn't play the role up to this point in the film the way that he did.
Yes. Yeah. We've had to see this evolution, so this adoption of Dolahide's persona, and now we've met Francis as well. It's like it's reminding us, it's just seeing Francis in this lovely kind of like hopeful scene, if you like. And it's like, but what is inside Francis is now what Will is just scratching the edges of, you know, and his eye, that boring into his soul. And it's just incredible.
I see you.
Love, this is like Spike Lee shots, you know. This is like, this shot is the traditional sort of tracking Spike Lee shot. You see it in so many of his films, but it's him that his imagination has brought him into the space with this couple. It's light outside. You can totally tell it's a complete, almost like waking dream sequence. and he's floating towards them.
And I see me desired by you.
And then this image at 1 hour, 29 minutes and 12 seconds. I was watching you prep for this episode and you're like, this is maybe the most evil thing that Michael Mann has ever committed to screen. And I think of that with this shot. It is watching her imperceptible eyes and teeth and the as shining like bright, bright lights. Absolutely terrifying stuff.
Yeah, it is the ultimate destination, the only destination for a character who's excavating his own humanity to imagine himself as not just a killer of other people, but as someone who has this almost religious or spiritual fetishization of himself and his victims. And what strikes me as so terrifying about this particular image is because we've been talking so much just in this conversation about how man uses light and commands light. And here's a scene where we see Francis doing the same thing by the proxy of Will Graham and imagining his victims as exploding with light. And this explosion of light within them must be his. It's something for him to almost suck up and eat and absorb. And like on a deeper level, there's something, I don't know, like classic movie monster vampiric.
Yes.
About what Francis the is gesture. Getting. Yeah. Is getting out of this. And it just, as I say, like it does feel like evil. And I don't use that word about many films, particularly like serial killer movies. Like, just to be completely honest, I'm not a true crime aficionado. I have a psych degree. It was like my main area of study before my life took a different direction. I get serial killers. I get what they are psychologically. They do not scare me on like a deep level. Like, they scare me in an immediate sense. I'm scared of serial killers. I don't want to die. I don't want them to harm other people. But they don't have that like spiritual despair that they in me that they cause other people. For me, that's like, I feel that, but about very different things. But Manhunter, this scene in particular, which is why I was so delighted that I got to talk about this scene, is one of the few examples in all of film that's a serial killer film where the serial killer nature of it genuinely feels evil to me. It transcends human psychology and becomes something else.
And it's also because the scene itself and the preamble to the scene with Lecter and Will, it's teaching us that Will is trying to see, you know, if one does what God does enough times, one becomes what God is. It's like Francis is becoming something, and Francis, Will has to become as close a proxy to Francis's sight to really unlock that final thing that's going to take him to that next level and be able to catch him. And right now we are seeing through Francis's gaze. Like, there's been a couple of times in the movie where early on we see Francis walking up the stairs with his sort of like lo-fi videotape ascent of the stairs to go into this house. We then seen Will do the exact same walk up those stairs, hinting at where we were going to get to with Will. And now we are literally here in this moment where he is imagining, he is inside Francis's dreams. He's trying to break into them and he's invading Francis's dream space. And when he sees that, it's like, if Francis's world looks like this, there is something really dark and wrong with him. And you know, we're seeing through that. And then in the following scene, which I won't tread on the toes of, it is that very contrast of seeing the world as it is and the world as Francis sees it that completely changes his behavior in an upcoming scene with Paul Ralph taking pollen from Reba's face. But let's just go back. I want to go back to this full zoom because it's so gorgeous and we can sort of talk around it and over it.
I see you.
Floating towards them.
And I see me desired by you. Accepted. And loved. In the silver mirrors of your eyes.
Gosh, no husband next to her. staged as she was, and the sheets are glowing white. The outside looks like an impression of some kind of purgatory or afterlife in that little fleeting moment, but it's 1 hour, 29 minutes, 26 seconds, and she's staged out with these things in her eyes, and the sheets is so crisp and white like they weren't when he first discovered the room.
Yeah, and this visualization reminds me so much of how in like ancient Greece, the, you know, the prophets,
yes,
they would keep these like virginal women high and have all of these kind of predestinational ideas about life and their ideas of how that kind of oneric,
yes,
dreamlike quality to them. And this to me kind of embodies a lot of that, but within a domestic space. And in terms of, I think those are like a series of dolly zooms. And within those zooms, that has such an impact because of the stillness of the camera in the preceding shots. It is so impacting. And, you know, Megan Abbott, your prior guest, you've already mentioned, she wrote this incredible essay. I think it was for Criterion, on the serial killer genre through the lens of Zodiac.
Yes.
Which you obviously had done a prior podcast on that we did together and as well. And basically she makes the case that like the best serial killer films, and Zodiac is one of them, does kind of get into that post-human world.
Yes.
Where it becomes about things bigger and deeper and wronger than the act of killing itself. And this particular scene where you're imagining, and Will is literally imagining and placing himself in this dream world of the killer, where his victim has become, as we were saying, this like thing to worship and destroy.
Yes.
In the same moment, and how he's killing for something beyond human consciousness and beyond human behavior. And the way man is able to represent this visually, and just the whole visual language of this scene, is one reason, as I've seen Manhunter more times, it freaks me out. Like I feel like a spookiness, like an aura around the movie for like days after I've seen it. And that's pretty rare. And I think, yeah, like at the film's best, and this is one of the best shots man, I think, has ever done, Dante Spinotti has ever done, there's something that at once seems extremely curated and precisely controlled and depicted, but it also just seems like it's coming from some other place.
Yeah.
Literally in the case of Will kind of summoning these visions, it does kind of freak me out. And I think that
I'm looking at your face while this is on the big screen, because this moment freaks me out too.
Yeah, it does. And I think that it works also so effectively because Will's face in this moment is this combination of just sort of mania, but also blankness.
Yeah, it's like intent and kind of, and it's like this strange sort of intent, but also satisfaction, but also, yeah, like you said, there's a mania. There's like, there's things flooding across his face, satisfaction, intent, purpose. And then like, but he's not there. He's not there. Will's not there.
Yeah. And so like this to me is one of the main shots of the film, is particularly the one where she's like sprawled out like, yes, this, because in a way there's like, we haven't said this yet, but like one of the things that terrifies me so much about this particular image is that the way Francis is imagining her and the way Will is imagining her through his imagination of Francis is that her position is almost one of welcoming.
Yes.
She's sprawled. She's not in a position of fear. She's in this position of like almost an ecstasy.
Yes. Come to like, bed. Come to bed.
Yeah. Exactly. And like inviting, yeah, Francis to make his kill.
There's like one tiny frame after this invitation and it's Will's face, one side clothed in sort of darkness, the other in this sort of halo light, and this intent and focus looking down. And he's about to say something. There's something else that's going to happen. And then we cut to the alien-looking spaceship of Francis Dolarhyde's van, which kicks us off into the next scene. Brandon, you're the best. Yeah. Not only do you have the best hair in movie podcasting and movie journalism, that was always fantastic. Wow, what a damn haunting and chilling scene. I'm gonna have to go and watch The Wild Robot again or something just to cleanse the palate after that. That's just a gross. Watching this movie in this detached way sometimes has good and bad things, and it's like that one. Just that's not a fun one. That's not fun.
But there's no one I'd rather feel my, you know, soul terrified with than you. So it all works out.
Ditto. Man, you're the best. Thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for being a part of the show. Thank you for traveling from Chicago to LA as a surprise treat for me. It was such a huge, I was so completely moved, and it's just been great talking to you again. And I think, you know, talking to people like you is why I like continue to do this show, because we take these things and scrutinize them to death. But, you know, I never tire of hearing your great insights about anything that you love. So yeah, man, it's great to talk to you, and you're the best. And thank you. I love you. Thanks for doing this.
I love you too, man. Thanks for having me.
Latest Michael Mann deep dive at One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to check out other deep dive series we've done on Michael Mann, go over to oneheatminute.com. You can find links to all of our previous shows, including One Heat Minute, The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, Miami Nice, featuring Katie Walsh and I in all modern man movies, including Collateral, Ferrari, Black Hat, you name it, it is there, and the Jimmy Carn Eulogy, One Thief Minute. Plenty of shows over there. If you want to support everything that we do, we'd greatly appreciate it if you checked out our Patreon/One Heat Minute. Over there, you can see weekly new releases. One Hot Take is the show there. You can also see The Decade Project, where we look back 10 years on the films that are still hanging around, currently working through 2014. They'll be on the main feed at the end of the year, but if you are a patron, for as little as $1 a month, you're getting them all throughout the year. And most importantly, as this is a Min Hunter episode, Min Hunter video podcasts will be popping up. Not every single episode, but most episodes will pop up as a video podcast as a drop there, so you can watch and consume and see all of the frames and images that we're talking about in all of these episodes. Every little bit of your support helps. So sharing, talking to us online at OHM Pods, or for myself at One Blake Minute on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.